Welcome. To the Cult of the Clock Tower. I am Andrew Nathanson, and here, every other week, a special guest and I have an in-depth discussion about a character from the game Blood on the Clock Tower. Today's character is the Imp, the Demon from the Trouble Brewing Edition, whose ability reads, each night, choose a player, they die. If you kill yourself this way, a minion becomes the imp. That too. It's not as epic, though, but you know, whatever. Anyway, enjoy the episode. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I am joined by Ben Burns. Ben, how are you doing?
It's very, very warm in the UK, so I am also very, very warm, which is bad, because I'm very hairy.
Well, that is quite a thing. Do you want to tell everyone a little bit about yourself, so that they know who you are? They might already know your name from things like the Kickstarter updates, but do you want to tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So my name's Ben Burns. I'm a resident of the UK. I am a member of the Pandemonium Institute. If you've seen live videos on YouTube, there's a pretty strong possibility that you might have seen me in some of them. I'm the guy with the really long dreadlocks. I'm head of community and community development for the PI, and I'm a huge, huge tabletop nerd and currently games journalist in freelance basis as well. So games and banging on and on about games is very much my cup of tea, so to speak.
Yeah. And today you're joining me to talk about the Imp, which is exciting.
It's an honor.
We're recording this a bit before this episode's going to actually come out, but this is going to be the last episode of the season here. So hopefully everyone has a good amount of knowledge about all the other characters, even if they haven't gotten to play that much, because all the other episodes are out. So
what you're saying is I'm the headliner.
Yes. Or alternatively, I've just been trying to, like, really putting off having you on the show, so, like, I really don't want to, and I was just like, okay, fine, I said I would, so I'll finally put you in here. but you can believe whichever one of those you want to believe. No, we're talking about the Imp today, so this is going to be a good one. There's a lot to talk about with the Imp, maybe not as much as, like, the spy and the drunk, but should be a pretty action-packed episode here. So obviously the Imp is the only demon in Trouble Brewing. So that means that everything we say about the Imp kind of is just like about being a demon in general to some extent. But there are also a lot of things specific to being the Imp versus the other demons. Not that there are any of those in Trouble Brewing, but just in general and how you play the Imp and like the different things you have to consider. So I think that'll be interesting stuff to talk about as well. But let's start where we do with every character, which is at the start of a game. You're the Imp, you're going into the game. What are you kind of thinking about? What are you trying to establish? Who are you trying to talk to? All that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, shall I kick us off?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I think, obviously, you pull that token out of the bag, your immediate thoughts are, as you've just said, what am I doing? What am I going to do? What's my game plan going to be? And I think the way the Imp differs to every other character in this regard is that you can, more so than any other character, assume a degree of partnership with the storyteller from the get-go. Evil mm-hmm. always start the game losing. It is the storyteller's job, 9 times out of 10, if not more, to back evil plays. And you are the captain of the evil team, for better or for worse. And so, when I've pulled the Imp token out a ridiculous number of times when I play, and it always makes me feel like a bad guy, because I'll be sat at some convention, I'll be playing with a bunch of people who've probably not really played much before, I'll pull the imp token, Ed or somebody who's running the game for me will just give me this look of abhorrence. So I've been the imp quite a lot, and you immediately sit there and think, right, that's my storyteller. How am I going to telegraph things to this storyteller? And everything for me kind of unfolds from there as the imp, I think.
Okay, interesting. So you're like very specifically making plans with it, having the storyteller's help in mind? Or maybe not necessarily help, but at least like they're not going to ruin your plans.
Yeah, because you rely on them you rely on the storyteller to a degree to execute your plans as the imp. You kind of have to think about how you're going to telegraph what you are trying to do to the storyteller. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, as someone who's I've storytold a lot of games. A big part of my role in the PI has been to travel around to conventions, and I'll be regularly running like 12 anywhere between a dozen and 20 games a day at a convention. And for a very long time I was doing that as my kind of day job, so I'd be just traveling around the country doing that. And so I've seen a million different ways people communicate, and you would be surprised by the number of people that would just walk up to me and say, hey, just letting you know, I'm the imp, obviously, and I'm doing this and this, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to do this or this or this as a result. And it's really interesting, because as a storyteller you almost feel like you have this kind of, not necessarily that you're, because you're obviously not on the evil team as the storyteller, that would be awful, but you do have a degree of connection with the imp that you don't have with other players. And I think that a good imp will exploit that, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with, as the imp, going up to your storyteller and going, hey, servant, this is what I would like for you to do today.
Yeah, and they're never obliged to listen, but most of the time they will, because like you were saying, you start at a pretty big disadvantage on the evil team in general, just being so far outnumbered, that you kind of have to work your way into a position of winning.
Absolutely.
Throughout the course of the game. Let's talk about, like, the main thing the imp does is they kill other players, obviously.
Sometimes,
so let's talk
even
about
themselves, right?
Yes. Let's talk about kill priorities in terms of other players. We can talk about killing yourself, or star passing, as it is colloquially known in some circles, which is how I'm going to refer to it, because I've gotten used to saying that. So just the listeners know, when I say star pass, I mean the imp killing themselves and turning a different minion into the demon.
I don't actually know the history behind that. Do you?
Something in the Sydney group, somebody started saying it. I think it's a term from roller derby.
Right.
There's like a baton or something, or a star, some kind of star that you pass. And for some reason, they started calling the imp passing to a minion the star pass, and that just kind of stuck in some groups, including mine.
I like that. That's very organic. I like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Please do continue.
So let's save the star pass discussion for later, because I feel like that's such a different thing to be doing than what you're doing most of the time, which is just killing other players. Although star passing is definitely a huge part of the strategy. Let's talk first about just kind of like your priorities in terms of what other players you want to kill. Do you have sort of do you have like a set of priorities for which other characters you'd like to kill first?
I think so assuming that the imp has some knowledge, it's time to kill, the storyteller wakes you up. Let's assume that at this point the imp has some knowledge, because obviously if you don't know anything, if you're completely flying blind, then basically you just kill someone random, or if you're perhaps a little less experienced, you might kill the guy who's talking the most, because you've played a lot of werewolf but you haven't played so much Blood on the Clock Tower. Let's assume you've got some knowledge. That then, I think, gives the imp a kind of a decision between two things. It's, am I going to kill someone who I perceive to be valuable, therefore removing them from the game, or is my kill going to be an act of obfuscation in the hopes of confusing the good team? And that you will often see that somebody will, let's say for example, someone truthfully stands up and says, I'm the washerwoman, here's all of my information, I'm now useless. And then we go to the night phase and the imp kills the washerwoman. And people will wake up and say, that's strange, why has the imp done that? What possible reason could they have for doing that? Is washerwoman, are you actually the washerwoman? Yes, I am. Oh, well, this is weird. Is the imp inexperienced? And immediately, by creating all that confusion, you've actually potentially earned more for yourself than you would have done by killing somebody valuable. So while there is definitely probably an order of importance, you want to get rid of that Undertaker, you want to remove the empath, you want to do this, that, and the other, actually by leaving those guys in and by killing someone who you might perhaps perceive as being less valuable, you may well have gained yourself more in terms of poisoning the well of information. And ultimately, that's what you as an evil team, as a unit, want to do, right? Because this yeah. isn't Werewolf. This isn't about conserving lives. This isn't about, you know, making sure you don't die early. This isn't about outnumbering the good team. You're probably never going to do that. What you do want to do is just stifle that flow of information, that just create as much confusion and havoc as possible between the moment the game begins and the moment the game ends. And so that's why I would almost err on the side of caution in terms of having a priority list, because everything's situational.
Yeah, I think it is super situational, but I do tend to think of it in like sort of two phases of the game. Usually in the early part of the game, I'm more on the side of killing the ongoing information gatherers. And then later in the game, if there are some who have survived and I haven't managed to kill, I usually switch into a mode where I start trying to frame them.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of things that can change that, but that is like very broadly what I'm usually trying to do in a game.
Yeah, I agree. And to be honest with you, that's the, if we were to write an imp playbook, that's what we'd put, isn't it? Kill the information gathering guys early, kill the valuable players early. If any of them slip through your fingers, and you feel it's too late to remove them without legitimizing them, frame them. And that's very much, or alternatively, keep them alive from early, befriend them and poison the crap out of them, which is also an excellent strategy in itself. But yeah, I definitely 100% agree with everything you've just said. But I do tend to prefer, and I'm more of a sort of play the people guy than I am a play the mechanics guy. In fact, for someone who is a member of the Pandemonium Institute, I have a pathetically poor understanding of the rules compared to like like Ed and John G, who you've had on the show. Those guys will wipe the floor with me when it comes to rules. But yeah, definitely agree with what you said there.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do things like that too. Like, one of my favorite things to do is if I'm in a group with mostly people who've played a lot, but like one or two new players, and those players survive a while, and I'm the imp, I love it when like a Raven Keeper comes out late. Like, they're like, oh, I'm probably not going to get killed. I just want to put my cards on the table. I'm the Raven Keeper. And I'd love to just kill them like the night after they do that, so that everyone's like, oh, okay, Andrew would never do that.
Yeah, or even better, take them to one side and say, hey, if you die, will you please pick me? Just because I really want to prove I am what I am. And then wait a couple of nights, then kill them. And when they come out and say you're the imp, just be like, that's preposterous. Why would I even ask you to pick me? There's just so many.
Yeah, I knew
so
you were the Raven Keeper. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. What about bluff priorities? I feel like this one is one where I definitely have a much less of a like idea of what I would do in a vacuum. It's so much more dependent on the game.
Yeah.
But I think it is possible that there are some bluffs that work better at different times, and especially when your group has a different meta, and you have to kind of keep track of how that changes over time.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting sort of, there's a tough decision to be made here as the imp, because you want to stay alive most of the time. Generally speaking, you want to live for all of the game if possible, or at least most of it. And so when you choose your bluff, you have a decision to make between, should I choose something that I can establish myself as early, or should I choose something valuable which I would then be obliged to be seen to be keeping secret and keeping to myself? Because I've seen a lot of excellent imp plays where an imp, and I've done this myself to be fair, and been bitten as a result of it. Like the storyteller will show me that there is no library, and that there is no saint, and that there is no, I don't know, monk or something, and I'll be like, that's brilliant. I'm the librarian. I'm going to grab two of my minions. I'm going to pull them to one side. I'm going to say, right, chaps, I'm going to pretend to be the librarian. I've been told that one of you two is the saint. You're the saint. You're the monk. You've told me that you're the saint. You've told me that you're not an outsider. Great. We've all got our lies now. Let's go sit back down. Which is an excellent way to start the game, because it gives you an excuse to talk to your minions. It gives you, you get your story straight nice and early. But the problem then becomes, someone will inevitably say, oh, you're the librarian, so you don't mind dying then. And, yeah. and then you've got a problem. The other side of the coin is to give yourself, and I've done this as well. I've I had a game about 6 months ago in the city of Derby where I actually, it was the same, basically the exact same setup. I got Saint, Librarian, and something else. Unfortunately, my minion was sat next to me, and I just kind of nudged him in the ribs and was like, "Oi, tell everyone that you need to speak to me privately." and then he stood up and went, "I need to speak to him privately." And then we went off to the side, and I said, "Right, okay, I'm the Saint, you're the Librarian. Somehow I'll get over to her and tell her that she's going to be the monk." And that worked quite nicely, but obviously you can't always rely on having a receptive minion sat next to you to pull that play off.
Yeah, that kind of only works if you have the minion next to you. Otherwise, you have to find an excuse to talk to them first, which is not easy if you're going to claim Saint.
Yeah, and it makes you look shady as hell, but that's a constant concern as the imp, isn't it, unfortunately?
Yeah. So I think there's, yeah, bluffing is so situational about what you learn and also just like what you've heard. Sometimes you don't necessarily need to bluff one of the characters you've learned about if you have a pretty good sense of what everyone else is.
Yeah.
There are also things that really change as the meta of your group changes, like some groups don't execute people who double claim because they assume that that's not the imp, because like the imp is supposed to know these three characters that aren't in play, so of course they would never claim a character that's in play.
Exactly, yeah.
But if your group thinks that, then that's a great reason to claim characters that are in play.
I mean, I'm a weird example, an unusual example, I'd imagine, of somebody who, like, most of the guys that you probably interviewed on this show will have a group that they play with more, like, not maybe 90% of their Blood on the Clock Tower is played with the same group, and they develop a group meta. Whereas I do have regular groups that I play with, but they are numerous. And for the longest time, I would have a monthly group in this place that I would go to, and a monthly group in that place, and I would just travel around the country getting various places set up and ready for when the game launches. And so I was part of many, many, many metas. And also, obviously, I ran a lot of games at conventions and stuff, so the vast majority of the Blood on the Clock Tower that I played was with relative strangers most of the time. Mm-hmm. And so I never really got the group meta that a lot of people have. And so consequently, I've learned to kind of cut through a lot of that stuff. Like, I don't think that an imp wouldn't double claim. It's not necessarily a bad thing as the imp to just make yourself seem shady or get yourself killed nice and early if you've definitely got a Scarlet Woman. But I guess that's probably a discussion for a whole other section, right? I'm probably getting ahead of myself a bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that there. I agree with you. It's totally reasonable to often make yourself seem shady and, like, really call attention to yourself. I do think that knowing you're, like, for most people, they're going to have a group with a solid meta, and if you can stay ahead of that meta, then you're going to be the one who wins most of the games.
Definitely, yeah. And in a sense, that's kind of a cool game within the game, I suppose, with a game like Blood on the Clock Tower. You are going to develop, you are going to be the leaders of your own little meta community, aren't you, at the end of the day? And yeah. It's like if you take a game like Magic the Gathering or something, a huge card game with an established meta, it's almost impossible to stay ahead of the meta. In fact, you almost don't get the enjoyment in a lot of these games of building your own deck, so to speak, and you know, playing with the mechanics and that kind of thing, because to be competitive, you have to basically do what the pros are doing. And that's one of the things that I love about Blood on the Clock Tower. You can have a little group where you have your own established meta, and you couldn't go. I've seen guys play in local groups that I've run, and then I've seen them come to a convention that I've been at. I've run a game for them. They've seen all these crazy nut job ideas go off where people, you know, committing suicide as the Virgin and things that they just never would have considered in their own groups, and then they've taken them back, and next month I've gone to like Cardiff or something and I've seen this guy be like, "I'm the Virgin and I nominate me," and everyone's just like, "Oh!" and it just have these revelatory moments where they've gone somewhere, they've grabbed some other group's meta and they've brought it back to their home group and blew everyone's minds with it.
That's great. So yeah, let's talk about the other things in general that you want to be doing, like at the start of the game. We talked a little bit about how to communicate with your minions, but I think that's a huge part of what the imp is trying to do. And, you know, it actually does touch on the meta. Like, if people are, like, most groups tend to go through a cycle of, like, being very suspicious of whispering people and then not suspicious and then, like, slightly suspicious, and it kind of finds a middle ground. So, but talking to a minion can be a pretty challenging thing if you want to do it effectively and not get called out for it.
Yeah, it's the ultimate. I think that probably is the most difficult thing about being on the evil team, because you can formulate strategies till the cows come home. You can talk about when you want to die, if you want to kill yourself, how you're going to integrate your strategy into the storyteller's plans, but it can all be for naught if you can't communicate with your team. And you have to communicate with your team as the imp. It's very rare that I've seen a passive imp who's sat there not talking to their team have a good time, unless there's some really high level play going on with extremely experienced and extremely familiar with one another evil players that just kind of know, they have a kind of telepathic thing going on with one another because they're so familiar with one another. It's very difficult to peel away and have those private conversations and to know when to do it. But and it's situational as well, isn't it? It's so situational. It's almost difficult to sort of to sit here and give and say you should do this at this time on this day, and because you just can't know, can you? And if you we've all been in those games where you've got that one really loud guy that's kind of leading the charge against everything, and often dynamics like that will determine when you peel off and whether or not you do it openly.
Yeah, I think it's that you just really have to feel it out, and if you can come up with excuses for it, like character-based ones, that can be good, but that can also end up locking you into something too early. You also have to be wary that, like, your minions can be working on their own to try to do things. Like, I've had several games where I have claimed the same thing as one of my minions, and we just didn't realize that we were both trying to do the same thing, but, like, inverse of each other. And then you kind of have to sort that out.
Yeah, and that can play to your strengths at times as well, and it can also help to leave your minions kind of out in the cold for a couple of days. Let one of them emerge as being shady, and then throw them under the bus. And we as human beings have this kind of... I've noticed that we have a kind of tendency to, when playing games like this, we'll have an idea in our head of a handful of people who we believe are shady. And through no logic whatsoever, the moment one of them is confirmed shady, at least by the beliefs of the group, it somehow gives the other ones a degree of exoneration. It's so fascinating to watch. And you can use that to your strengths as the imp. You can allow all of your minions to appear shady, throw one of them under the bus, and then just put that little seed in the minds of everyone. They're like, oh, well, you know, Catherine is now confirmed spy. So that must mean this guy and this guy, who we thought were evil before, they're probably good. We're probably barking up the wrong tree with those guys. And just having that little bit of psychological nous in your pocket can really, really help when throwing your friends under the bus like a jerk.
Yeah, but that's your job.
Exactly. Pro jerk.
Yeah, and that's another thing you can kind of play by ear, because sometimes you'll become the person accidentally who's the most shady. And then that's the perfect time to star pass, and you can kind of lean into being shady.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's kind of where team synergy comes in for the evil team, because the good guys are never going to have that problem, are they? Or none of them are going to benefit from appearing shady. Or at least it's a very rare scenario where a good player will somehow benefit from seeming shady. But the evil team can use that. That's another benefit of being able to take your guys aside early and be like, hey, look, if one of us emerges as the baddie, let's just embrace it. Let's just agree that we're going to throw ourselves under the bus if that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely games I've seen where the evil team isn't really working together and they end up arguing with each other to the extent that, like, the minion throws the demon under the bus instead of the other way around, and that's not good.
Yeah, it's a classic. I see it all the time at conventions. You get some poor soul is looking terrified whilst I'm giving the rules explanation, and then they pull the imp out of the bag and they just sit there in silence for the entire game because they're terrified of losing the game. Because I imagine it must be, I was fortunate, I didn't pull an imp out of the bag until I'd run hundreds of games of Blood on the Clock Tower, but it must be daunting for your first ever game. You pull the imp out of the bag, and because you are the only guy in that room really that can lose the game for your team. Like, yeah. None of the good players have that pressure on them, do they, really? And I always try and make a point of saying this in my rules explanation now, like, none of you guys are going to ruin the game for your team. None of you are going to lose the game for your team. Just have fun, poke and prod, see how it goes. But the truth is that there is one person in that circle who I'm lying to, and that's the imp.
That's definitely true. And unfortunately, the more they think they're going to lose the game for their team, the more likely they are to.
Exactly.
In my group, we had the same person get the imp the first three games in a row, which was quite funny.
That just always happens. Like, every group I know has got the imp guy, who is the imp all the time. It's like, how can this continue to happen? It's so mathematically improbable.
Yeah. Well, one thing I always think about when I'm thinking about communicating with minions is the investigator, because that's the one townsfolk that most of the time I've noticed they come out early, and until they do come out, I'm always a little bit more cautious about who I talk to, because talking to a minion who's been seen by the investigator, if that investigator is doing a good job and really watching that minion, then you're just going to be under a lot more scrutiny than most other situations. So I usually want to wait at least a little bit to see if there's somebody who wants to come out as investigator, because that's one of the strongest things that will, like, create that shady person. And just being aware of that right at the start is always something I like to think about.
Yeah, and that ties in quite nicely to the previous point of when should you sneak away and talk. And if you are fortunate enough to have been awarded competent minions, then hopefully you can rely on them to do that. And especially in a large game where it's more likely than not that we have an investigator, at least mathematically speaking, as an imp, it you can hopefully be a bit passive on day one and day two and just allow your minions to come to you. Allow your minions to make up the reason, because it doesn't matter if they seem shady in the long run. Obviously, it's a great loss if your Scarlet Woman or your Poisoner dies, but it's not the end of the world, where it pretty much is the end of this game's world if you die. So hopefully sitting there and allowing them to come to you can take a bit of that suspicion off of you. Although, I don't know, perhaps you might feel differently, that just having a shady person want to talk to you, that the investigator is seen as potentially shady, implies that you might be shady as well, guilty by association. I don't know, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I usually think that if there's someone I know as a minion, there's like one person they want to talk to. So, like, thinking from the investigator's perspective, I usually would interpret like the first person they talk to as being slightly more suspicious than other people. It really depends on the person, though, because like if they're a person who's really confident and will just come out with a bluff without talking to their demon, then that changes things. But if there's someone who is a little bit more timid, and I think is going to want to, like, hear something from the demon before they decide what they're doing with the game, then I'm watching them especially closely and going to really distrust the people they talk to early.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that almost formulates an argument for saying, if you are a minion, go talk to literally anyone but an evil player first.
Right, until everyone expects you to do that.
Yeah, and that's where the group meta thing comes in.
So speaking of minions, how expendable are the different minions, do you think? Or just minions in general? Because this is like many things, there's kind of two sides to this coin. You can treat the minions as completely expendable and just make sure that they keep you alive, or you can treat them as very valuable so that you have lots of options to star pass later.
That is a great question. I think, I suppose everyone will approach it differently, and it depends on your playstyle, but for me personally, it goes without saying that the Poisoner is a very useful tool in the evil team's arsenal. It also goes without saying that the Scarlet Woman is a very useful tool in the evil team's arsenal. The Spy's great, but most of their usefulness happens in the early game. And while it can be handy for them to see how things are changing at night, to a degree, if they've got a semi-decent memory, they've done their job within two nights, I would say. The Baron is the Baron. that's what he is. So the downside of any good player dying by execution is that it may clue the good team into the fact that an evil player has died, which has far-reaching consequences that are too numerous to discuss right now. But this is the very scenic route to this answer. My personal feelings on this matter is that the evil team has an egg in their nest which they must protect, and that is the life of an of imp, whoever that imp may be at the time. And everything else is secondary to that, and everything else is expendable compared to that. So, and that will change depending on who you've got, right? So if you've got a Scarlet Woman, then the protection of the egg in that nest is a little bit easier. You can afford for the one mother hen to die because another one will take its place. and in this bizarre analogy that I've just been crafting right now for some reason, that's the way I see it. And so how expendable the evil team is, well, in a general sense, I'd say the minions are always expendable to a degree. And all of them except for the Scarlet Woman are more expendable than the Scarlet Woman, because the only thing that matters when you get down to that last day is that you've still got a demon in the game.
I personally like to really try to keep a sense of when I'm about to die when I'm the imp. Because there are some games where you'll just, like, for a long time, you're like, okay, there's a lot of discussion about all these other people, so, like, surely one of them will be executed before me.
Yeah.
And when that happens, I like to spend my time making it so that the minions are a little bit more valuable and trying to keep them alive. That way, in case they do survive all of the other attention that they're getting, like, if they end up being the one that it's like, oh, okay, we've decided we don't trust this person, we do trust this person, kind of. The group as a whole generally decides that. Then when the attention kind of comes around, it's like, why is no one talking about Andrew? Then as soon as that happens, I just have to, like, survive for one more day as soon as the discussion turns to me, and then I can star pass and, like, it's clean.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of depends for me on whether I'm, like, part of the discussion at the start of the game or if that only starts happening later.
Definitely. I mean, it goes without saying that the more teammates you have alive, the better. That's just an undeniable fact. And it's certainly, if I think there is a tipping point in most games with this, where you either embrace the carnage on your team, or you or you attempt to keep many players alive. If you get to sort of the near end of the game, and there are six people alive, and three of them are evil, at that point, you're wanting to keep as many evil players alive, right? Because you're thinking, this is going to be an easy win. We're going to win before the end. And even if we don't, on the last day of the game, it's going to be a choice between two evil players and one good. Whereas I've seen games where, like, the Scarlet Woman has died on day one, and the evil team are like, right, the training wheels are off now. There's no safety net anymore. Let's just blow ourselves up and hopefully juggernaut our way through to the end. And that's a legit strat as well, because if you can position yourself as the imp, as though you are, if you can gain early confidence in you, that confidence it's very difficult to erode, especially as you transition into the sort of second half of the game where the general attitude towards killing people becomes more cautious. Because in the early game, you'll know, most of the people listening to this podcast will know, you don't really care about killing people a great deal, do you? It's seen as a means to an end, as a way to garner information, as a way to feed the Undertaker more info, as a way to ensure that the empath will be getting new info. But there comes this tipping point in the game. Suddenly people are more reticent to execute. And if you've garnered yourself a reputation as somebody too valuable to kill by that point, you can worry less about your own life and therefore be less concerned about the value of your minions' lives.
So what about the situation, though, where you do have a Scarlet Woman?
That's just a very, very wonderful luxury, isn't it? Having a Scarlet Woman. And obviously, at that point, I suppose, you get into a point where you're thinking, are we going to utilize this? Because once there's less than five people left alive, the Scarlet Woman might as well be the Baron, right, at that point?
That's the thing. It's actually, like, if you were planning to use the Scarlet Woman's ability, I feel like you should actually actively try to get it to trigger most of the time, because if you end up playing a risky strategy that doesn't quite get you executed before the last day, then it'll often leave you in a really bad position on the last day.
Yeah, definitely. And anything that you can do to sow confusion and doubt in the minds of the good team is always going to be useful, right? And vastly outstrips any damage done by losing one evil player 9 times out of 10. So yeah, absolutely, definitely. Star passing is probably the best thing in the arsenal of the Imp. And even better than a star pass is being executed and having a Scarlet Woman pick it up, right? Because that just sows even more confusion. And I mean, that's one of the very interesting things about the Imp, actually, because the whole star pass concept, as I'm sure many people will be aware, is unique to the Imp. And it's one of the things that I find people who've played the demon, who've played the Imp in Trouble Brewing, when they move on to the other scripts and become a demon in that one, they immediately realize just how paper thin the other demons are when compared to the Imp in terms of... Because you die, it's over, right? Unless you're the Zomboul or something, that's it, it's over.
Yeah, or sometimes it takes them a game to realize that, where they're playing as the demon in some other set.
Yeah.
And then they point to themselves at night, and I like give them a weird look, and they're like, wait.
Oh, are you sure?
Yeah, actually, I've had a lot of people who didn't realize that was an Imp-specific ability. They were just like, oh, that's just like what the demons can always do in Blood on the Clock Tower, yeah. But no.
I've taken to just incorporating it into my rules explanation now for people who've not played advanced scripts. Just be like, the ability to kill yourself and pass it on is specific to the Imp. Please do not do this.
Yeah. So let's see, I think we've already talked a good amount about when you want to kill yourself. What about nights when you want to... not kill? This would obviously be to support a specific bluff of like a soldier or a monk, but you can target a dead body and not kill anyone. What are your thoughts on that?
Personally, I think that you should not killing somebody for no reason is an excellent thing to do, because it is so confusing for the good team. I've seen it happen. I've seen imps just be like, just arbitrarily pick a dead player. And then the good team will wake up and be like, right, guys, let's figure out how that happened. Does anyone claim soldier? No. Is anyone aware of the existence of a monk? No. What the hell's going on? Why has no one died? And immediately you just sow in all of that confusion. And obviously, it goes without saying, if one of your minions is bluffing as a soldier and you want to legitimize them, great, don't kill anyone. If you're claiming to be the monk and you want to legitimize that, great, don't kill anyone. But there is a lot to be said for just having a night of not killing anyone just to confuse people. Because it will get brought up later on. Like, in the discussion in the final day of the game, it will get brought up. John's a really experienced player, and we've already established we don't have a soldier or a monk. Why would he not kill someone on night two? You know, and it's just... It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing to do, and I would encourage all imps to do it at some point.
I'm really getting a sense of your style here. I see you like the just like random chaotic things that cause everyone to talk about something else other than trying to find you.
Yes, because I'm playing to my strengths, because I suck at Blood on the Clock Tower. I suck at Blood on the Clock Tower, but I'm really good at convincing people that very outlandish things are actually possible. That's where my strength lies.
Nice. All right, let's see. There's one more thing I want to talk about with the Imp, but is there anything else you wanted to talk about in like the main section here before that?
No, I think we're good. I think we've covered everything there.
All right, so the other thing I want to talk about, you're familiar with the Fiddler, right?
Yes.
So for anyone who doesn't know, the Fiddler is a fabled character, which is basically like the storyteller can choose to put this in as kind of an extra rule. It's not really a character that anyone plays. It's just like the storyteller plays this character that changes the rules somehow to accommodate various circumstances that can come up in the game or like in the venue, just to make it so that you can play the game more smoothly. And there are various fabled characters, but the Fiddler is one of them. The Fiddler allows you to end a game early, basically. You can correct me if I'm wrong about any of this. But the Fiddler basically lets you end a game early by allowing the demon to choose someone at night, and then in the morning you announce that one of those two people is the demon, and everybody has to vote on it. Is that a good summary of the Fiddler?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So this is usually used when, like, oh, suddenly everyone has to leave or something.
Yeah.
Well, I guess... most likely not everybody would suddenly and unexpectedly have to leave, but like, I don't know, the venue you're playing in is closing or something. And for whatever reason, you can't continue the game. So you just want a way to end it, and this is a fun way to do that.
Yeah, I've actually been the Imp in a game where the venue was closing, and Ed, who you've had on the show, was the storyteller, and he brought the Fiddler into play. So I've got some degree of personal experience with this. Although, having said that, I wasn't the imp anymore because I had killed myself on day two and passed it on. But we did have a fiddler ending. It was really fascinating. But basically, we were at a convention in the south of England, and we had invited a load of people to come and join us in this great big 20-player game of Blood on the Clock Tower at the end, just assuming that would be fine. And then, like, 3 days into the game, a security guard came in and was like, excuse me, guys, what are you doing in here? You've got to leave. I want to go home and have my dinner. So Ed was like, oh, great, what are we going to do? So he brought the fiddler in. And it was actually really, really interesting. I'm acutely aware, I'm just going to start banging on about the fiddler here, and we're not actually talking about the fiddler, are we? Do you want me to reel this in a bit?
Well, we should talk about the fiddler, because I think that actually the fiddler is secretly part of the imp's ability sometimes.
Yeah, that's true.
Not just because, like, obviously the fiddler has to do with the demon, but because you can force a stalemate to happen, which can only be resolved by the fiddler. So this can happen if the town doesn't want to execute somebody. Like, say there's four players alive, and they're like, well, we want it to go down to three, so we have a better shot. But you don't want to kill anybody. You can kind of force the game into a position where the storyteller eventually just has to be like, okay, fine, we're going to do a fiddler.
That's a very good point. Yeah, very good point. Yeah, so basically, Ed brought the fiddler in, and we had to choose between two people. But it was very interesting because we had a mixture of very experienced players, we had a mixture of total newbies, and a bunch of people who were somewhere in between. And this whole group had to come to a very early consensus on limited information. And the guy who was the imp, this poor man, had never played before, and I'd star pass to him without warning him, and he was just like a deer in the headlights as he was desperately trying to justify why he shouldn't be killed. But it's an interesting scenario to be in as the imp, because you don't expect to have to justify yourself this early. And so I suppose what you then have to muster is what people are inevitably going to ask you is, what are you and what have you done, right? And so for that reason, you should always have something in your back pocket.
Yeah, especially in the case where, like, a fiddler does end the game early. It's a little bit different, though, when you're deciding to be the one who's forcing the fiddler to happen, when you do reach that kind of stalemate.
That's true, yeah, that's a very good point. Because
then you've had the whole game to think about it, you're very close to the end of the game, otherwise a stalemate wouldn't be happening. So I think that those are two very different situations, actually.
Yeah, because one of them is a strategy that you're employing, right? And the other one is a thing that passively happens to you, whether you like it or not. And so when it comes to the actual strategy side of it, I suppose the question is that preferable? Or what do you think the situations are where you would intentionally force a fiddler ending?
In my opinion, there's only really one situation where it makes sense to. Because in a vacuum, what you're doing is you're making it so that now everyone has a choice of one of two people instead of one of three people. So that is just worse for you in general. The only time I think it's really useful is if there is a mayor that everybody trusts. Like, you're very confident that if you go down to the final three, the good team will just win via a mayor.
I don't think I've ever seen a game where there is a mayor that everybody trusts.
I don't think I've ever seen a game where that happened either, but I have seen games where the imp thought that would happen and thus decided to force a fiddler to happen.
Yeah. I suppose, in a sense, as the imp, let's assume that there's you, the imp, and two good players left alive, and you know these two guys are good players because they're not on your side. So I suppose in that situation, as the imp, you're probably the only person still alive who has any insight as to whether or not that guy's the mayor, right? In fact, at that point, you're right. Almost certain that he is, because why would he lie about that and try and lose the game? So, yeah, that's actually... I'd never considered that, but that is actually a very good point.
I hadn't either until I had a game where it just kind of happened naturally, where there was a mayor, and the demon didn't want to go down to three players, so it stayed at four. No one wanted to execute, and then eventually someone was like, well, what do we do in this situation? I was like, well, there is the fiddler. And then after that, for a few games after that, that actually happened like two or three more times before people started realizing, like, oh, maybe not. Maybe this doesn't actually work that well. Because the demons just started assuming that the mayors were way more trusted than they actually were, because they knew for sure that they were the mayor. But you got to remember that most other people do not know that.
Yeah, and obviously you by trying to employ that tactic, you kind of run the risk of somehow getting to a situation where you do actually have three players left alive, and then the mayor does have the upper hand. You've really got to, you've got to see that coming from quite a way away, right?
Yeah, I think just at like four, when there's four players alive, you just got to make sure that if there's no executions and you think everyone trusts the mayor, that's like a good time to start thinking about maybe using this strategy. But basically, as soon as you decide to use it, you're locked in. Like, unless there's a monk or something that is another way to explain there being no kill, you're kind of locked into using the strategy and committed to forcing a stalemate as soon as you don't kill the first time. Otherwise, it'll be like, oh, they started to do this, but then they backed away from it? Why?
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting strategy. But I think that's never going to be your first choice, right? Is it? You're never going to be like, this is what I'm going to do this at the end of the game. It'll be amazing. You're never going to... That really is imp backed into a corner play right there.
Yeah. I suppose you could also do it to back up your own mayor bluff somehow. I don't know. I feel like there's a world where you can somehow use this to make yourself more believable as a fake mayor.
Yeah. That again, is something that I've never considered, but that is actually really interesting. Oh my God, I'm going to be such a better imp after this share. Really.
You know, I really wanted to bring this one up because I've never seen that happen anywhere outside of my own group where you have the imp forcing fiddlers to happen to avoid a mayor.
It's going to become core meta now that we've discussed it. Every game is going to have an imp pretending to be a mayor, pretending to be an imp, pretending to be the game.
Yeah. So yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there. You know, try it at home if you want. Make sure everyone knows about the fiddler first, because the first game where that happened, it was kind of awkward because like nobody realized that this was an option, so I kind of brought it in out of nowhere. But yeah. All right, let's move on to the second section here, which is fighting the imp. This is the section we always have when we're talking about an evil character. This is a little bit different than when we're talking about fighting a minion, because fighting a minion always involves the uncertainty about whether or not that minion is in play. With the imp, kind of your whole goal in the entire game is to fight them. So, yeah, we can talk about that in general, which is just like, what are you doing to try to find the demon? Although I feel like that's ground we've covered in general.
Yeah.
I think the main thing to talk about here is fighting against the imp's star pass ability, which is like the thing that makes them different from other demons in other sets.
Yeah, definitely. Because ultimately, your job as a good team is to remove the possibility of the imp, right? Not necessarily the imp. And if you play with relatively experienced players, you will often hear the phrase, yes, I agree, he probably is the imp, but there's no point killing him now because it will just go to a Scarlet Woman. And it's very common, and I'm sure you've heard it as well, right, to hear that phrase said. And that, to me, exemplifies fighting the imp. You're not really fighting the imp. You're fighting the imp's evil organization.
Yeah, and you also, like, I think one of the big things is you don't want to, like, play your cards too soon if you think somebody is the imp, because if you say that you think someone's the imp and you are correct and you have like most people on your side but not quite enough to get an execution, that gives them time to get away.
Yeah,
so it's like that's why the good team, I think, in Trouble Brewing more than the other editions, is often going to want to have like small alliances and little like sidebar discussions all the time, because if you can have a group of good players who are executing a plan to kill the imp on a specific day, that will be more effective than arriving there by group discussion when the imp is also listening in and can play around it.
Absolutely, yeah. 100% agree. And that's something that I've seen a lot of... If you have the privilege of running a lot of games with a lot of different people, and you'll often find yourself in situations where you've got, say, a large game, like a 15-player game, and 8 of them are brand new and 7 of them are really experienced. And you really get to see the difference there between the way good players take on the imp. And I've seen it firsthand dozens of times. That poor old Ed, who I'm sure, I know I keep bringing Ed up, but like most of my anecdotes for some reason involve Ed. But I've had games where Ed has been sat there on the good team, something really valuable like the Undertaker or something, and it's Ed and like 9 total newbies and a bunch of evil players, and Ed will be like, we need to do this, oh, I'd like to have a private conversation with you, and doing all the things that you need to do to keep that that information away from the imp, and he'll just get killed on day two because someone will inevitably go, has anyone noticed that this really experienced guy is controlling everything? And I'll be like, no, I'm not. But yeah, you're
only doing that because nobody else wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. Poor old long-suffering Ed. But yeah, you are absolutely 100% right that you need to pick your moment when revealing your stuff to the imp. And you'll often, and oftentimes you'll find that it goes right until the very end of the game. And that sort of, that key period of time when there's like 5, 4, 3 players left alive, that's when all your info dumps come out. And that's when you find out that actually everybody believes this one guy is probably the imp. Or in fact, actually we've all got conflicting information and the poisoners played an absolute stormer of a game. But yeah, you definitely do need to keep that away, because the moment the imp catches a sniff of the fact that you guys might possibly maybe execute them, they're immediately going to star pass, right? And they don't care whether or not it makes them seem shady, because their job is done now. They can just sit and have a beer and watch everyone else play, basically.
I think a situation that comes up a lot in Trouble Brewing, much more than the other editions, is a good player saying, we need to kill this person. I'm not going to say why, but there are enough people here who know why that we should do it. And
yeah.
I've seen that happen so many times, and I actually think it is good.
Yeah, you're like sat there as the recluse being like, I don't know why. Will someone tell me why?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think that's the main thing about fighting the imp, is just like, don't let them know when you're onto them, if you think you're onto them, until you're ready to do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, I would even advocate, you could even go a little more extreme with that and be like, don't even worry about fighting the imp until way late in the game. Because, again, to bring up the werewolf example, most other social deduction games are about the conservation of lives, right? And most of them, the good team loses when the evil team has more living players than the good team. That's not the case in this game. It doesn't really matter a great deal how many of you are still alive, as long as you don't get way beyond the point of no return. And so, fighting the imp, the best way you can do that is gather information. And the only way you're going to stifle yourself from gathering information is if you waste your time trying to kill the imp, right? You should be killing pretty much... I mean, obviously it's great if you kill the imp, fantastic. But really, your concern should be mainly with who can we afford to sacrifice in order to gain useful information. How can we ensure that the info that we have is useful and not poisoned by the poisoner, or not misinformation spread by the evil team? And so I would say that to fight the imp, this is going to sound like some sort of ridiculous Chinese proverb, but to fight the imp, you should avoid fighting the imp.
Yeah, that actually ties into something I want to talk about in the next section, which is like how much, like if you think about it, the evil team has a very difficult job ahead of them at all times. They have to survive like a 1 in 15 chance of execution, then a 1 in 13 chance of execution. And like, and obviously the later in the game goes, the more you can just like kill the imp by random chance. And I feel like that's a big part of the reason why you don't need to focus on killing them until later. Because the later you go, the more likely you are to get the imp.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you can use the early game when you have those less probable executions, if you can use those executions instead of like as the small chance of getting the imp, if you can use those instead to generate more information that will help you add, like even increase your probability even more towards the end of the game, that's when you can start bringing those probabilities above 50% and above 75% or whatever, so that you're actually more likely to win than lose by executing the person you think is the imp.
Yeah, definitely. And also by executing people who volunteer for execution, you're just speeding up that process, right? Because they're dead and they're checked off the list, because I don't want to go on record as saying that, but it's unlikely that they're evil if they volunteered to die on day one.
Yeah.
And day two and day three, etc.
Yeah, okay. So I think that about does it for section two. It's kind of hard to talk about fighting the imp like this entire podcast. All of the episodes about good characters are kind of about fighting the imp.
Yeah.
So
because ultimately when you're fighting the imp, you're fighting the whole evil team, right? You can't really specify it.
Yeah, fighting the imp is trying to win the game. So as long as you're doing that, you're doing the right thing. All right, let's move on to this third section here, which is Things to think about while you're running the imp as the storyteller, and this is probably an especially important section considering you're doing this every single game. So, let's start by talking about the thing you mentioned right off the bat, which is that in the early game, the storyteller is generally working with the imp to some extent to help their plans come to fruition, because the evil team is at such a disadvantage right at the start of the game. So what do you want to say about that?
It's a very difficult balance to achieve, because you can't give the good team exclusively useless information, because that would be unfair. Generally, it would be unfair, and also it would be counterproductive to the whole ethos of the game, which is that you have to sift the truth from the lies, right? That's the essence of playing on the good team in Blood on the Clock Tower. But you also absolutely should take opportunities to mask the imp's identity and to give the good team some conflicting information, because the evil team start every game losing, right? That's just a fact. They are massively outnumbered. They are the least likely to win at that point in time. And so the question then becomes, how do you do that? And it's always situational, because every single game will be completely different to every other game. I realize I've just given you a complete non-answer there. It's basically just said, all of these things are facts. Here's no answer. But it, as a general
it is
rule,
really
yeah. I mean, here's the things that I've noticed from running thousands of games of Blood on the Clock Tower. The most common person that I see people give false information to protect the imp is obviously the empath, right? If the empath is sat next to the imp, you've immediately given the evil team are losing even worse, right? Because that is absolutely catastrophic for them. And so, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say this or not, but I believe in asking for forgiveness rather than permission. But in our internal testing for Blood on the Clock Tower, we found that by quite a margin, the most common townsfolk that was made into the drunk was the empath, because of that very reason. Because the empath is so destructive to the evil team's plans.
They're also like, they have one of the most variable power levels of any character based on how the game is set up.
Absolutely.
So having the drunk as an escape hatch for them is good.
But sometimes you don't have that option, right? Sometimes you've already handed out all of your outsider tokens. And so in that situation, you just have to you have to hope for the best. But then what you can do at that point is, if you've got, and this works for any character that is about to get some ironclad info that you know is going to be key, you can attempt to create information that contradicts it. And that's the main thing, because you can give weird info all day, right? Can't you? You can throw out all sorts of crazy stuff that makes no sense at all. But ultimately, as a storyteller, the only way that you help the imp is by giving information that is both plausible and contrary to what the team already believe they know. And that's the secret formula right there, isn't it?
Yeah, and just to be perfectly clear, this is about when people are drunk or poisoned, or you have ways to give them misinformation.
Of course, yes. Don't just be a horrible storyteller and break the rules of the game. And I mean, to be fair, that's one of the things, like, the most common question that I get asked at conventions is like, so as a storyteller, you could just do whatever you want, right? And it's like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You are bound by the rules, but within those rules, there is some wiggle room, and that's what makes the game cool.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that, because there are definitely, I mean, if people have listened so far to the podcast and listened to most of the other episodes, then they probably
probably know what Blood on the Clock Tower
is. Just in case, just in case anyone that wasn't clear. I think that's exactly the key, which is just like, when people are drunk or poisoned, or you have ways to give misinformation, you do it in ways that are plausible and will actually actively hurt the town. Will like actively contradict the things they think they're doing, and will throw them off the scent of the demon, or at least the evil team's plans.
Yeah, and because if you, when you play with an inexperienced storyteller, that along with forgetting to give out the three bluffs and not using their knight tokens properly, the most common, not necessarily mistake, but the most common sort of indicator of a beginner storyteller is that they won't really be thinking a great deal about the misinformation they're giving. They will just give, they'll be like, well, the chef is supposed to see a one, so I'm going to show him, I don't know, a three. Great, here you go, three. And immediately the chef's probably going to look around the room and be like, well, I'm poisoned or drunk. And that right there is a wasted opportunity, really. Unless you believe for the purposes of balance, the chef should start the game knowing that their information is false, that is a wasted opportunity to balance the game and to make a more interesting and nuanced game and to ultimately help out the imp.
So let's talk about the other big thing, one of the things you mentioned there, which is giving bluffs to the imp, because that's another huge thing you're doing as the storyteller that will decide a lot about how the game goes, or at least influence it.
So I see on your notes here you've got rules of thumb. Is there a formula for this?
Yeah, so I don't really use any kind of rule of thumb or anything, but I have heard other people saying such things, so I wanted to get your opinion on that. Like, do you have any rules of thumb you use or general things you think about when you're giving bluffs? Because I can talk about the things I've heard and generally what I'm thinking about, but I don't really have any hard and fast rules.
Well, yeah, I'd be interested to hear what you think about before I say anything, actually, if that's cool with you.
Okay. Yeah, so most of the time what I'm giving the imp is something to do with how the rest of the roles are set up on the board. So I try to show them, like, I mean, it's really tough. It's situational. But if I have nothing else to go on, I'll usually like to give them one outsider. I guess that's like the closest thing I have to a rule.
That's interesting.
Other than that, it's just like I'll usually show them something that I think would be some things that I think would be helpful for them to bluff. Things that I think they could get away with. Because I'm generally trying to help them, obviously, and like we were talking about earlier, you want to help them. I try to give them a mix of like different strategies they can take. Like I might give them something that would be a pretty risky bluff. Might give them a way to encourage discussion with their minions. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have much of. I don't have much in the much that I think about for this. It just varies from game to game so much.
Yeah, what I found interesting about that was the statement of one outsider. What is your reasoning behind that?
In Trouble Brewing, especially, the outsider count is often a thing that comes up very early in the game and ends up being a ongoing topic of discussion. I like to just give the evil team a hook into that discussion. So by showing one outsider, or at least one outsider, that just automatically hooks them into that part of the discussion, opens up. And I also just think that outsider bluffs for the evil team and like confusing the number of outsiders makes most games more interesting.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I guess that's just why I do it. I just think it's an interesting part of the game that I like to be on the table at all times.
Yeah, that's a good shout. That is, I agree. That's very interesting that you think like that, because that's not at all how I operate as a storyteller. But that's definitely a good thing to do. Perhaps better than my thing to do, to be fair. But yeah, that's interesting, the whole one outsider thing. Because I don't really think about it in terms of townsfolk and outsiders. I generally will look at what I've got in the box left to give as bluffs. I often won't even think about bluffs until the night phase has begun. And I'll do it quickly a lot of the time, sort of in the moment, if you like. But I will often give the evil team a set of characters that can lead to some interesting plays. So I suppose on a subconscious level, I'll often give them a Night One character, especially if I've not got many Night Ones in the actual game, because that always gives them an excuse to go and talk to one another, and that also gives them some knowledge of what the good team does not know. So if they know that there is no, for example, librarian in play, then, like you've just said, they can work the outsider angle. They can work the whole, do we have a baron, don't we have a baron sort of angle. And obviously they can synergize that with the number of outsiders that are supposed to be in play. So if they know the good team has got no librarian, and if they know there should be zero outsiders in play, and if they know that they do not have a baron, that means all of the outsiders are on the table immediately, right? And by giving them the librarian, you've actually given them four extra bluffs, or three extra bluffs, straight out of the box there. So there's so much you can do with that whole outsider dynamic, and I hadn't even not even occurred to me until you brought it up just then. But yeah, I'll generally try and give them a role that I consider to be powerful or important or risky. So saint, undertaker, monk, something like that, that will give them a reason to, that will give the good team a reason to want to keep them around. And then generally just anything really. the third one's a wild card, but I think that you probably put more thought into this than me, which again ties back into earlier on what I was saying, is that I actually suck at Blood on the Clock Tower. I'm just like to watch people be charismatic.
Well, I like to think about it, but I don't always put it into practice. There are often games where I go to the night phase and then I wake up the imp, show them who the minions are, and then realize, oh, I totally forgot to think about what bluffs I'm going to give them. So I just pull some random stuff out. That happens too, but I try to think about it when I can.
Have you ever shown the demon the drunk?
I have never done that. I wanted to talk about that because you can totally do it. I kind of feel like you shouldn't ever do it, but I don't know. Are there ever? Have you?
Yeah, but only when I wanted to gimp the imp. What a phrase. Yeah, basically, when I've been playing at conventions and like some guy that I've seen play, like that, someone I know is a veteran has signed up for a game, and it's that person and like eight total newbies, and they pull the imp token out of the bag. The one experienced player pulls the imp token out, and my thought in that situation is like, you only get two bluffs, experienced imp, because you're going to wipe the floor with these poor unfortunate souls who have never played this game before. So that's the only scenario under which I would show the drunk to the evil team. But actually,
it does technically give a little bit of information,
because
knowing that there isn't a drunken play can tell you some things, like maybe you haven't had a chance to communicate with your minions, you don't know if there's a baron or not. And you don't know, like, maybe the good team isn't going to come out right away with their outsiders, but, like, knowing that drunk is on the table can allow you to bluff that.
Yeah, and I think in a larger game as well, in a larger game, it can have hidden depths, because a big strategy for evil players is the, well, I might be drunk. Like, how many evil players have I seen pull that out of the back pocket the moment someone starts pointing out quite rightly that their information is nonsense, and so knowing that there is no drunk in the game, knowing that there is never going to be, or it's highly unlikely that an undertaker is going to determine that somebody was actually the drunk, could actually pay dividends down the line. Is it more useful than having three bluffs for your four evil players in an 18 player game? Absolutely not. No, never ever.
No. Yeah.
But it is interesting, and I would be intrigued to see it used more by storytellers. So if there are any storytellers out there who would like their players to hate them, start doing that on the reg and write in, drop me an email, let me know how it goes.
Yeah. There's another specific thing, like I like thinking about it in terms of what information you're giving them, even if they don't choose to bluff as it, because really, like, we call it giving the imp bluffs, but really you're just telling them these characters are not in play.
Yeah.
And that is also just information they can use. So, like, if they know there's not an investigator in play, or they know there's not a fortune teller in play, even if they don't choose to bluff as that, and if no evil player ever bluffs as those things, just knowing they don't exist can influence your play style. So, like, if you know there's no investigator, well, maybe it's a little bit safer to just get up and talk to a minion. If you know there's no fortune teller, well, I don't even know how you would exactly respond to that. But
I think the Undertaker is the classic one, right? If you know there's no Undertaker, you can get yourself killed. And that opens up a whole new... Because you can be like, guys, I'm the librarian. I've got all my info. I'm happy to die right now. Get yourself killed on day one. You know for a fact that no Undertaker is going to discover that you're actually the imp. Control the whole game from behind the scenes. You know who the evil guys are. You've bought yourself a degree of trust from the room that you could never normally hope for as an evil player. And you can just kind of subtly nudge people away from executing your Scarlet Woman, etc.
Yeah, exactly. So it really is just like part of every demon has somewhat of an information ability that just gives them some more info about the game.
Yeah.
So thinking about it in terms of that and not just in terms of bluffs is also useful.
I agree.
All right, what about which minion should take a star pass when it happens? Obviously, if there's a Scarlet Woman, it has to be them.
Yes,
but
yeah.
In another situation, or if the Scarlet Woman is poisoned, how do you decide?
I think that that is dependent on where the game's at this point. I've had games where the evil team are getting smashed from moment one. Despite my best efforts to help them, nothing seems to be working. Then the imp is executed, and I've got a choice between a Baron and a Poisoner. And it's like, well, I'm definitely going to make the Baron the new imp because I don't want to take away their Poisoner. And then
yeah,
obviously,
so rather the imp kills themselves at night, not executed.
Oh, sorry, my apologies. Yeah, but the principle is still the same, of course. You know, the evil team are having a rough time. The imp's been found out. They've not really made any headway. The imp star passes at night. You make the Baron the new imp because you don't want to take away the Poisoner or you don't want to take away the spy. You want to give them as much of a fighting chance as you can because you feel like they're struggling already. And then you've got the opposite version of that, the converse of it, where evil are absolutely hammering everyone. The imp decides to star pass to make their hammering even more hammery. And you think, nope, you guys are absolutely battering these kids. I'm going to take away your Poisoner. I'm going to make the Poisoner the new demon. And that will balance things. And so, obviously, there are a few scenarios, I think, as a storyteller, that are more about you balancing the game than choosing where the star pass goes.
Yeah, definitely. I don't really have anything else to say. That you pretty much summed up exactly what I think about it as well.
Yep.
All right, and the last thing I wanted to talk about here is the question of, is evil ever really in a winning position in Trouble Brewing? Because really, every game, it's going to come down to a 1-in-3 shot of getting the demon at the end. And, like, if the good team has any information to go on at all, it's going to be closer to a 50-50 shot at worst. So I feel like that's something I always like to keep in mind, is that because I've seen so many times where I think the evil team's doing great, so I do something that, like, slightly favors the good team, and then it just turns the entire game on its head and the demon gets killed, like, right away. And I've just seen that happen so much that I've started to really play more on the side of, like, favor the evil team when possible, even if I'm pretty sure they're already doing well. It's like, no matter what, the good team's going to have a 1-in-3 shot at the end. So it's never, you can't hurt them, or you can't help them so much that you can mitigate that.
Yeah. I think that if we identify, why is the evil team always kind of losing? It's because they have one guy who, if they die, they'll lose the game most of the time.
Yeah.
The good team doesn't suffer from that affliction. Under what scenario is the evil team winning? Under the scenario where the good team is suffering from that affliction. So if you've got four evil players and one good guy left, the evil team is winning because it is now more dangerous. There are now as many good guys that could lose the game for good as there are evil guys that could lose the game for evil, if not more. So I'd say it's rare, but it is mechanical. That's how you determine whether or not the evil team are winning. It's mechanical. Whereas for whether or not the good team are winning or losing or doing well, I suppose doing well or doing poorly is a better way to put it. Whether or not either side's doing well or doing poorly, that's often based on assumptions and on educated guesses and stuff like that, isn't it, really? It only becomes a definite thing. It only becomes a definite case of good losing if it travels over into the realms of actual mechanics, I would say.
I think there are, like, lots of times where it seems like everybody just trusts the imp, and that might make you think as a storyteller, like, oh, okay, the evil's in a good position, so I should help the good team more. But I feel like that kind of rules out that, like, as the game progresses, a lot of the reasons that they trust the imp will disappear, because as more and more people die and you cross off a bunch of other imp candidates, even if they were more highly suspected, just as the field narrows, it's like, okay, well, now we have to start reconsidering who we trust, and that process will often take something that seems like really certain, like, oh, there's no way they're going to execute this guy, and you just, like, the way the group decision works as a, like, kind of a hive mind, it's really unpredictable.
Yeah, you've totally hit the nail on the head there. Yeah, 100%. Because what will it, and it happens it, whether you're the imp or not. It's just that it's just part of being the guy that is trusted, and it goes beyond Blood on the Clock Tower into societies, communities, politics. Like, eventually, somebody is going to say, "Hang on a minute, this guy that we've been trusting. Why are we trusting him? We've forgotten why we're trusting him. Why, you know, what has he done to deserve this trust? And then immediately that creates a spiral of doubt in everyone's mind. And it's something that you can employ as an evil player, but it's something that you should expect as the imp, and by virtue of that, expect to happen as the storyteller. And that's why I think it's probably risky to ever look at that grimoire and think, evil are definitely winning here, because that will inevitably change in a heartbeat unless it's mechanical. And if it's mechanical, if it's gotten to the point where, as we said earlier, there's say 4 evil players left and 2 good guys left, then perhaps that's just unfortunate. Perhaps there was nothing you could do. But more likely, it's probably that you made the wrong decision as a storyteller at some point, and got the evil team into this incredibly strong position. And it happens to all of us. Obviously, I'm not. I don't want to call people out or anything like that. I've done it many times, but that's probably just you being a little too overeager. And that summarizes why it is so difficult to be a good storyteller. You're always riding a fine line based exclusively on assumptions.
Yeah, even though it's similar to what I said about the spy, actually, in the spy episode, which is, even though you can see the grimoire and you know everything that's mechanically happening in the game, you don't know the very important piece of information, which is what everyone's thinking about what's happening in the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose as the storyteller, maybe you do have a bit more access to that kind of thing. You can flit around and listen to people's conversations, yeah, but you can't be everywhere at once, and you certainly can't be inside people's heads.
Yeah, for sure. All right, was there anything else you wanted to say about running the imp as the storyteller?
I really want there to be something else that I wanted to say. I feel like when someone says that, it's like in a job interview, isn't it? Is there any other questions you want to ask? You've got to ask some questions, otherwise you look like an idiot. But no, I don't have anything else I want to say, as much as I wish I did. I think we've done...
You can just say the thing that that some of my guests have said in the past on episodes, which is like, this is a good character and you should put it into your game more often.
Definitely.
You should be putting the imp into your games all the time.
Yeah, it might seem a bit non-standard. It might seem a bit weird and fruity, but I would heartily encourage you to put in this extremely underutilized character in your games of Trouble Brewing.
I really like. I don't see the imp enough in these games. All right. Well, thanks for talking to me, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a really good time. I actually think I'm like 10 times the storyteller I was an hour and a half ago.
Wow, that's impressive, considering you're one of the most prolific storytellers in the world already. to everyone at home, thanks for listening. I should probably talk about this now. I don't really know what I'm doing after this episode, because I'm not quite ready to start on another edition yet. I was hoping to get to play them a bit more, but then the whole, like, you know, coronavirus thing started. So I lost a bit of playtime that I was hoping to get before having to talk about them. So instead, I'm going to be doing some other things. I'm going to be having some other discussions, like catching up on things I think I missed about other characters and just various other discussions. But yeah, that's what you can expect from this podcast in the near future. Thanks for listening, everyone. You'll hear from me in a couple weeks. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.